The general thrust of the Bible is very much that those who follow God are seen to prosper, while those who don't fail. As such, there appears to be only so much godlessness from Israel and Judah that God can take before he inevitably calls time. The idealized reigns of David and his golden son Solomon are ancient history, and any virtue that was inherent in the monarchs who the Jews were told were chosen by God has long since left the building. It's like all tragedies, awful to be a part of, but utterly compelling for everyone else. Right here is where the moral decline of both nations that set in the first book of Kings culminates in a gripping sequel. My name is Chaz Bayfield, and this is Holy Bible Episode 84, The Firestorm. Season 11, everyone, and I can promise you it's high octane stuff. Murder, subterfuge, child sacrifice, revenge. It's easy to forget that only around a quarter of the Bible contains stories like these. Much of the rest is poetry, prophecy, teaching, or letters, none of which rattle along with a kind of pace as the second book of Kings. That's not to say it isn't highly readable. I can't wait for the steamy love fest that is the Song of Songs, though driving our tour bus through all 150 of the Psalms could be an altogether very different adventure. No plot lines, just a lot of songs. Still, these are both a long way off. Right now, the action swings between Judah in the south and Israel in the north, as both kingdoms attempt to ride out the tumultuous geopolitical landscape of the ancient Near East. Let's jump in. Written during the Babylonian exile, possibly by the scribe Ezra, much of the first part of the second book of Kings is given over to the escapades of the prophet Elijah and those performed by his successor, Elisha, who appears to be one of the few godly men left in Israel. The book kicks off with a typically dissolute and idol-worshipping king of Israel making a typically ill-informed decision to consult Baal rather than God. For those of you new to this podcast, Baal is a pagan deity worshipped by Israel's Canaanite neighbours. Along with Dagon, Molech, Asherah, and Ashtaroth, Jews are forbidden by God to worship him. God is particular about this, even adding it in as one of the Ten Commandments, the fundamental laws by which all Jews must live. The God of the Bible is holy, a word which means set apart, and according to the book, he expects his people to worship only him. In the last episode, we saw how King Ahab died in battle and had his blood licked up by dogs. Using Ahab's death as an opportunity to get out of paying money to Israel, the leaders of the neighbouring nation of Moab rebel. Israel's king, Ahab's son Ahaziah, has recently fallen out of his bedroom window and, incapacitated and no doubt concerned, he sends envoys to find out from the pagan god Baal if he will recover. Ahaziah fell through the lattice of his window and possibly dropped several stories to the courtyard below. The fall was enough to injure him badly, but not kill him outright. Elijah hears of Ahaziah's plans. According to the book, he is informed by an angel who sends him to intercept the king's messengers and ask them if there is no god in Israel who the king can consult instead. The message from God is that Ahaziah will now never get up from his sickbed and will die in it. The men take the bad news back to their king, and when they describe the prophet as a man with a garment made of hair tied up with a belt, Ahaziah realizes that his men have met Elijah. Keen to hear from the holy man in person, he sends an army captain with 50 soldiers to summon him to the royal palace in Samaria. The men find Elijah sitting on top of a hill, and he tells them that if he is truly a man of God, fire from heaven will destroy them. Sure enough, a sudden and spontaneous firestorm consumes every one of them. Undeterred, the king sends another delegation of exactly the same size. And again, Elijah promises death by fire as proof that he is a genuine prophet. Fire then consumes the unfortunate messengers. When a third cohort arrives, the captain falls on his knees before the prophet, begging not to be torched like the previous two missions. His humility pays off, and the book describes how Elijah hears from the angel that it is safe to follow the man down the hill to the palace. Once there, the prophet repeats the message from the angel that Ahaziah will die because he bypassed God in favour of Baal. The king expires shortly afterwards, and the book points out his lack of a male heir, the suggestion being that this adds to his disgrace. The action now moves away from the kings of Israel and Judah and focuses instead on Elijah and Elisha, two of the most miraculous characters in the Bible. After a remarkable life peppered by incredible achievements which the Bible credits to God, Elijah's last act is the icing on the cake. Unlike most mortals, Elijah doesn't die. He is a rare subset of human beings that include the antediluvian ancient Enoch and Jesus, who all manage to reach heaven while they are still alive. Elijah appears to know that he is about to leave the earth, and on his way from Gilgal to Jericho, he tells his protege Elisha that it is time for them to part company. Elisha refuses to leave, promising to follow his boss everywhere. The men stop at Bethel. It's possible that Elijah is visiting the communities of prophets based in Bethel and Jericho one last time before he vanishes. Being prophets, the holy men who live in Bethel all know what is about to happen, and as Elijah and Elisha pass through the community, they fall over themselves to ask Elisha if he knows too. A kind of ancient holy one-uppery. Elisha tells the men that he does know. It appears to be a difficult time for him, and Elijah seems keen not to upset him any further by having him witness his dramatic exit, which is why he keeps trying to leave him behind. Again he tells Elisha to remain in the city while he goes on ahead, and again Elisha refuses. Finally, the men reach the River Jordan, tailed by a posse of 50 prophets. Here, Elijah rolls up his cloak and strikes the water with it. Immediately, a path appears across the river, allowing him and Elisha to walk across. Elijah offers his friend one last wish before he leaves, and Elisha's is a big one. He wants twice the amount of spirit that Elijah has. It's quite an ask, but Elijah tells him that if he sees him vanish, then that power will be his. It's a clever plan. Elijah has no control over what happens to Elisha, but he assumes that God has the power to allow the younger prophet to witness his disappearance or not, and whether or not to give him double Elisha's spiritual chutzpah. As the men are talking, a chariot and horses made entirely of fire appears between them and takes Elijah into the sky using a whirlwind as a road. This event inspired a line in William Blake's 1808 poem, Jerusalem. Bring me my spear, O clouds unfold, bring me my chariot of fire. As well as, of course, the 1981 Academy Award winning movie, Chariots of Fire. Elisha appears distraught. Elijah has not only been like a father to him, but he was more valuable to national security than any number of chariots and horsemen, and now he is gone. Elisha rips his cloak in anguish before spotting Elijah's own cloak that must have fallen off before the prophet disappeared. Taking the cloak back to the river, he asks where Elijah's God is before striking the water of the river with the garment, just as Elijah had done. Suddenly, the water parts, allowing him to cross back over to the hugely impressed prophets on the other side. The men can see for themselves that Elijah now has the same power as his master, and they offer to use their manpower to look for Elijah, who they assume must have been teleported to a nearby mountain or valley. Knowing that his friend and mentor has gone forever, Elisha tells them not to bother, but they insist. Too embarrassed to refuse, he lets the search party go ahead, but after 3 days with no success, they finally call it off. Elisha remains in Jericho, where the locals appear to have a problem with their water supply and their manners. Crops are failing due to bad water, and the people assume that this is something which God can fix. They fetch Elisha, who asks for a bowl and some salt, which he pours into the spring that provides the town's water, announcing that it has been healed forever. Sure enough, the water is cleansed, and readers are told that the spring has remained pure ever since. Being a prophet commands respect, so when a group of young men fail to show Elisha any, they pay the price. On his way back from the miracle at the spring, the prophet passes through the town of Bethel, where some youths decide to yell "Baldy" at him, telling him to get out of their town. Hilarious as this may seem to them at the time, the smiles are soon wiped off their faces when the prophet asks God to curse them. A couple of angry bears come out of the woods and savage the youths, mauling 42 of them. The bears that attack the boys will most likely have been Syrian brown bears, which are now extinct in Israel and Palestine, but survive in Turkey, Iran, and Iraq. Elisha then visits Mount Carmel, scene of Elijah's triumphant showdown against Baal back in episode 81, as well as Samaria, the centre of power and pagan worship in Israel. He possibly comes here to reflect on the great man and teacher who has now vanished from his life, before continuing his journey back to Jericho. Like Elijah before him, Elisha is a prophet who has the ear of royalty, and soon he is brought in to help crush a rebellion. The episode where Israel's king Ahaziah falls out of a window and never recovers coincides with an act of defiance on the part of Moab. With Ahaziah dead, his brother Joram takes on the role of leading Israel, and though he is no poster child for righteousness, he is described as not being as evil as his parents Ahab and Jezebel, which, given that these two murdered a man just to get hold of his garden, isn't exactly a glowing reference. Still, Joram does remove the stone of Baal, which appears to be some kind of effigy worshipped in a purpose-built pagan temple erected by his father. He may not be as evil as Ahab, but Joram is easily as agnostic as all of his predecessors, leading back to Jeroboam. As such, he's seen by the Bible as guilty of leading his people away from, not towards, God. While Ahab was alive, Moab's king was compelled to pay him 100,000 lambs every year, plus 100,000 fleeces. It's an astonishingly heavy tax, and there's no record of why or when this amount was agreed. What is certain is that Moab is subservient to Israel at this time, and when Ahab dies, it seems a perfect opportunity for Moab to cash in on some potential instability within Israel and call a halt to the payments. Israel's new king sees this as an act of rebellion, and to show Moab that he is not to be messed with, he decides to invade. Evidently not trusting the military firepower of his own country, he ropes in his southern neighbour Judah, whose king Jehoshaphat seems more than keen to have a pop at Moab. In order to reach Moab, the armies must travel through Edom, and Edom's king also appears more than willing to join in the fight. After 7 days, the armies still haven't reached Moab and have run out of water for themselves and their horses. Joram in particular seems frustrated that God has brought three kings together only for them to be overpowered by Moab. Jehoshaphat suggests that the kings consult a prophet, just as he and Ahab did, before joining forces against Aram. Someone points out that Elisha is among the troops. The suggestion is that he has been sent by God, knowing that he will be needed. Hearing that the great Elijah's successor is available, the three kings head off to find the holy man. Elisha wants to know why Joram doesn't consult the pagan prophets beloved of his parents, Ahab and Jezebel. In a moment of humility, Joram suggests that God might actually want to deliver the three kingdoms into the hands of Moab, and this is why they need to consult a prophet who is actually connected to God. Elisha reluctantly agrees to intervene, but only because he respects Jehoshaphat. Randomly, he calls for someone who can play the harp, and, remarkably, a harpist is found, though why a harp would make its way into battle is unclear. To the backdrop of melodic music, the prophet announces that the valley will fill with pools of water that will quench their thirst, even though it hasn't rained. It's simple for God to do this, Elisha says, and Moab will capitulate thanks to God's intervention. Moab will then be punished for its rebellion, its towns will be overthrown, its springs blocked up, and every useful field littered with rocks to make it unfarmable. Meanwhile, news has reached Moab that a hostile coalition of kings is preparing for an invasion. Every man who is strong enough to carry a weapon gathers on the border with Edom, and overnight, just as Elisha predicted, the land fills with water. When the Moabites watch the sunrise, the red reflection of the sun's rays make the water look like blood. There's no reason that the Moabites would think that this is the sun's reflection on water, as it hasn't rained. Convinced that infighting has set in and that the three armies have slaughtered one another, the Moabite troops arrive in jubilant mood to plunder the camp. The armies of Israel, Judah, and Edom then pounce, and Moab is annihilated. As soldiers flee, the coalition army invades Moab and sets about destroying towns, blocking springs, dragging stones into fields, and chopping down trees, utterly ruining the kingdom. Only the capital city, Kir Harasheth, remains intact despite being attacked with slingshots. Sensing that the battle is lost, Moab's king Mesha grabs 700 swordsmen and attacks the Edomite army, but fails. Knowing that he has lost, he takes his son and heir and sacrifices him on the walls of Kir Harasheth, possibly in an attempt to appease his god, Chemosh. The book describes that there is now great fury directed against Israel, possibly because the military action has led to such a horrific act. According to the Old Testament, child sacrifice is one of the pagan practices which God detests the most. Possibly as horrified as everyone else, the three kings and their armies retreat to their own countries. One day, Elisha is directing an attack on an enemy nation, the next, he is helping a friend. After the assault on Moab, Elisha turns his attention to more domestic matters, and the book tells a sequence of stories that depict the prophet as one of the most impressive miracle workers in the Bible. The widow of one of the holy men who he lives alongside comes to him in a state of high distress. Her husband may have loved God, but he owed money, and now his creditors want to take her two sons as slaves in lieu of payment. Elisha needs to make a quick audit of what the woman owns so that he can best help her, but all she has of value is a small jar of olive oil. Olive oil is not just kept for cooking in Old Testament times, it's a valuable product that is also used for light, medicine, and cosmetics. Thankfully, one small jar appears to be all the woman needs. Elisha tells the woman to collect as many storage jars as she can from her neighbours, as she's going to need them. She is then to go inside with her sons, lock the doors, and pour oil from the tiny jar into all the other jars. As each jar is filled, she should put it to one side. The woman obeys Elisha, and she and her sons form a production line, filling jar after jar. In the end, there is so much oil that she runs out of storage completely. At this point, the oil stops flowing, and the woman returns to Elisha to await further instructions. The prophet's advice is simple economics: sell the oil, pay off the debt, and live off what is left. However, it is Elisha's next miracle that sets him on a par with Elijah and possibly even Jesus. A friend's child dies suddenly, and in a time before emergency ambulances and highly trained paramedics, the situation is utterly hopeless. These are extraordinary chapters. Interspersed between stories of kingdoms battling kingdoms are much smaller events, and the sense is that although the leaders of Israel and Judah are often godless, God is still at work in their nations. It's also interesting that while a large chunk of the Old Testament is taken up with books by prophets such as Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, Elijah and Elisha appeared to write nothing down. Instead, their deeds were so remarkable that they lived on in oral history, until a scribe picked up his quill sometime in the 6th century BC and committed them to posterity. The miracles continue next time. Holy Bible is written and produced by me, Chas Bayfield, with music by Michael Old and John Hawkins Music. Cover art is by Lisa Goff. If you have any feedback or questions, please email contact@holybible.com. I'll spell that WHOLLYBUYABLE. Or you can chat to us on X, simply search Holy Bible Podcast. Don't forget to tell family or friends if you like what you hear. And if you like reading, you can find Snakes and Angels, a secular walk through the first 5 books of the Bible, that's Genesis to Deuteronomy, on Amazon. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time.